Welcome to Positions, the podcast of the Cultural Studies Association, sponsored and published through the open source journal Lateral. Positions aims to provide critical reflection and examination on topics in cultural studies for scholars, students, and a general audience. Make sure to follow CSA and Lateral Journal on socials and subscribe to our podcast to keep up with new episodes. In our first episode of season two, we're joined by the Globalization and Culture Working Group to discuss Fan Yang's newest book titled Disorienting Politics, Chimerican Media and Trans-Pacific Entanglements, published by University of Michigan Press. Fan is joined by two special guests, Kathleen Rosano and Mark Tang Putterman. Enjoy the discussion.
I'm Kathleen Rosano. I am chair of the Globalization and Culture Working Group for the Cultural Studies Association. I am visiting lecturer at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, in the Media and Communication Studies Department.
I'm Mark Tung Putterman. I'm a postdoctoral fellow in the Asian American Studies program at University of Pennsylvania. Glad to be here.
Hello, I'm Fan Yang, professor in the Department of Media and Communication Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County as well.
And I'm Dolores Phillips, I'm your host and the vice president of the Cultural Studies Association, and I run the African, African-American, and Diaspora Studies Center at James Madison University, and I'm also associate professor of English.
I really appreciate the way in which you're able to mobilize this idea of Chimerica and Chimerican media to reveal the way in which the China and America part of that works to mystify other ways of thinking, of living, of being, of forming solidarity with other groups around the planet, whether it be around questions of labor, whether it be around questions of environmental justice, whether it be around questions of who has the right to debt, or what is it to experience to be in debt. And so I think that the way in which you work through these examples of Chimerican media to get us to this final place where we're thinking these transnational entanglements are ones that bind us together in forms of commonality that media often work to eclipse or erase. And what you show us is that we can start to explore these in ways through conceptual frames of disorienting and this relational politics.
Thank you so much, Katie, for that question. And I just want to quickly mention that I always credit Katie for bringing me into cultural studies from way back. And such a great honor to have her here to raise these insightful questions and give me the opportunity to talk about what gave rise to the project. And I should just quickly mention, too, that I did not coin the term Chimerica. The term actually came from Niall Ferguson, who is an economic or financial historian. When he was using the term, he was primarily thinking of the so-called economic symbiosis between the so-called superpowers, that is, the United States and the People's Republic of China. But I happened to have seen this play in London back in 2012. And that play also took the name from Niall Ferguson, called Chimerica. And at the same time, it was appropriating it to really get at some of these entanglements of China and America, especially in the 21st century. In some ways, I was inspired by that particular play and start to think about at this particular moment. And I've also decided to use Chimerica as a shorthand to refer to very deep, complex entanglements, be it economic, cultural, political, and ecological. And so as I use Chimerica to describe these entanglements, in many ways, those entanglements can be seen, or they are made visible
through these media artifacts that I call Chinese-American media.
Fun, in your previous book, which was called Faked in China, you actually look at the move from made in China to create in China, and like the Chinese state project for that was, I was thinking of it dialectically, and you say that actually in that mix, what we find is a whole new sort of area, which was faked in China. And I feel like you're doing a similar dialectical discussion in your new book, Disorienting Politics.
One connection I do want to think about is the chapter where I talk about Firefly. And I, again, want to thank Katie for alerting me to it, because I remember back in the day when I share my observation with her that, oh, when I watch things like Bones or Dr. House, these like main characters who are brilliant, they also oftentimes happen to speak Chinese or understand Chinese. Something's going on. And then that's when Katie said, oh, you should watch Firefly. And at that time, I didn't even know it was already a cult series, and it was quickly canceled, of course, even though it later on became a film too. So I engaged with that artifact in that chapter of cultural Chinamerica in terms of this imagination of Chinese language as the global lingua franca of the future, both on the sides of American cultural producers like Joss Whedon, who uses Chinese speaking or Chinese slang in the show Firefly as a way for the main characters who are underdogs to form these alliances among themselves and create these intimate connections within them, and really also projecting the different vision of community that was also lacking in neoliberal America. Whereas on the other hand, you also have Chinese state entities trying to imagine building a strong linguistic nation, building things like the Confucius Institutes globally. But then that, of course, became controversial in the U.S. due to many of the xenophobic sentiments. So try to bring them together again to think about what competing visions of culture emerged in these different discourses. And I think I do actually feel there's something very intriguing about Firefly. And I should say that when I first saw it, I also didn't quite understand. I, even as a native Chinese speaker, I'm like, what? But then realizing how genre bending it was as a show, and how there's a very deep layers of hegemonic, counter-hegemonic struggles as they are associated with Chinese speaking or not. So I feel like moments like those are actually really worthy, even though they could be short-lived or very much taken up as a subcultural form, but they are still very much worth looking at as these moments that have in themselves some kind of political possibilities.
So there are a couple valences that I want to parse that I think are particularly useful and stood out to me. The first is, coming from a Cold War historical perspective, I think what's so useful and interesting to me about this book is that it shows the ways in which Cold War American discourses about China have evolved, but also remain very durable in certain ways into the 21st century. And so I think that your book does such a great job of tracing how this ideological binary between liberalism and authoritarianism, as represented by the United States and China, respectively, remains such an anchor for the ways that Americans think about and talk about China. And of course, that is very much an inheritance of this Cold War discourse of communism, the form of fascism or totalitarianism. And I think what your book does is it shows how, in such a very different moment in which, as you're tracing the role of kind of transnational circuits of media between the U.S. and China that are so very different from that Cold War period, that kind of these ideological paradigms remain so hardened. And even as the circulation of these media objects in theory increases, the opportunities for connection or intimacy or understanding between American and Chinese people, I think, as you emphasize, this absent presence of China remains. And that kind of connects to the second point that really stands out to me, which is, I think what's really useful about your framework of Rising China is that it provides a way to think about how to theorize U.S.-China relations through analytical inheritances of post-colonial studies, of cultural studies, and operationalizes an understanding of U.S. imperialism on the one hand, and specifically these inequities between the U.S. and China that I think continue to dictate both the material relationship between the two countries, but as you're emphasizing, this discursive context in which Chimerica is a conjoined manifestation of the U.S. and China, but not on equal terms.
I recall when I was finishing the book in amidst the pandemic in 2020, and I realized, oh, this is a marker of 20 years of living in the U.S. as someone who came to the U.S. from China in 2000. So my life is exactly split between the two. And it's very interesting to observe China, or what I call this figure of rising China, from the vantage point of America, especially as we inhabit this, or what I would call American media life. I think that the understanding of relational politics stems from this kind of epistemological betweenness, both geographically, but also as someone trained in cultural studies, I also have this interdisciplinary in-betweenness. I'm not really bound by any approaches necessarily, but I'm also really interested in the production, circulation, and consumption of media artifacts and process. That's where I see the possibility of approaching these objects and mining them in some ways to see what we can gather in terms of a different understanding of our beings in the world. And for me, as an interdisciplinary cultural studies scholar and someone who has been working on media and globalization, I really want to think about them together through thinking more critically of the connection between media and politics. So the way that I get at my argument is that even though if you dig into how these media artifacts came about and how they enact these entanglements, you really get a sense of how interconnected we are as humans. But at the same time, there are ideological demarcations that mask these relations in such a way that it really delimits our imagination of politics that extend beyond the place of the nation. The way that I try to push forward this understanding of relational approach to politics is to argue for a greater understanding of these interconnectivities between media, people, places. That way, perhaps we can try to envision a different kind of politics that is simultaneously tied to the place, but also deeply engaged in the creative spaces that are created by media.
I was deeply intrigued by what you said on page 127 through 128, where you wrote, "My core argument has been that while Chimerica need to make visible the numerous entanglements of the two superpowers, the ideological framing of the Chinese state as a racialized other has eclipsed the possibility to engage these entanglements as a basis for imagining politics anew." Can you speak to that very briefly?
I think it does demand deeper investigation. The way that I discuss in the book, for example, is try to think about this figure, what we may call rising China, that's very distinctive in a 21st century phenomenon. And in some ways, it is a non-human entity, if you think about the state as not necessarily in human terms, as the category of race has historically been applied, or racialization has historically applied. But at the same time, if you think about the type of figuration or configuration of that agent, an actor, the COVID moment comes to mind. If you think about the rhetoric of China virus, for example, there is this figuration of the Chinese state as an actor. So that kind of formation of the Chinese state as a subject in cultural studies, we like to use
this notion of formation of the subject. And it creates the condition for it to be then objectified and dehumanized. And if you think about the off description of China as anti-human rights or superhuman when it comes to some Olympics training, perhaps, that also corresponds to this kind of China as the non-human, China as the superhuman or subhuman. And then a third reason, perhaps, is also, as we know, in the COVID moment, there's a spike in anti-Asian racist attacks in the U.S. And many might argue that, well, there is a longstanding presence of yellow peril, that is describing anti-Asian racism that is very particular about Asian bodies. Whereas phobia historically has been the term to describe a fear of China, the Chinese government. And to me, at this moment, when we have the very material presence, but also very imaginative one, rising China, perhaps it's really important to think about, well, why this, why now, as the longstanding cultural studies question, a research question, why this particular form of anti-Asian racism? Is there something quite connected to the figure of rising China? And that is, to me, an opportunity to theorize, to lend a lot of analytical precision to this figure of rising China and how it manifests itself in Chinese-American media. And so that's the goal here.
I think your use of rising China as a way to get at this contradiction between the way that China is represented as this superpower, as both dehumanized and superhuman in certain ways, and yet still operating in kind of an unequal discursive terrain in which, in the context of American media or more broadly, Anglophone and Western media, China is an agent and yet also is not able to speak for itself in, I think, equal terms. And so this contradiction of rising China as both indexing discourse of China as superpower, but also representing this discursive inequity, I think, is a really important way of bringing some of these frameworks of empire from post-colonial studies, from Asian studies and global Asias towards really like a contemporary analysis of U.S.-China relations.
Thank you so much. I want to quickly follow up. There are two things that your great comments, really appreciate that. Your comments reminded me of, so the first thing was the influence of post-colonial thought on my thinking in relation to China. And I feel that, as we know, post-colonial critique not necessarily oftentimes has China in the framework, with the exception of scholars like Dan Vukovich, perhaps. So in some ways, it's quite important to think about how post-colonial presence manifests itself on the plane of the imaginary. And that was the case of how I talked about intellectual property rights regime as this branding imaginary that has shaped the Chinese state and the Chinese cultural producers and consumers. Whereas in this case, I really actually appreciated Mark's framing of the discursive inequity. And in the Chinese context, there's also the term 话语权, like discursive power or your discursive right. There's House of Cards, which is one of the chapters, that is a Netflix production that became supremely popular in China. But I have yet to see something of that kind of equivalent that comes from China and became as popular as how popular House of Cards was in China. So, of course, we could think of the more recent production of The Three-Body Problem as something pointing to a perhaps different future, given the fact that this was one of the first globally popular Chinese sci-fi by a Chinese author, won the Hugo Award, Liu Cixin's The Three-Body Problem, a trilogy translated by Ken Liu wonderfully into English. The fact that Netflix picked it up and produced its own version. But interestingly,
remapped it in ways that depart from a lot of the original narratives. So yeah, I would like to imagine perhaps there are things shifting and in terms of this discursive inequity. But to me, at the moment of my writing in the first two decades of the 21st century, I think it's also important to point to the very material dimension, as Mark pointed out, of China's presence. If you think about American media life, if we understand media as contents, while they are still conveyed through all these material objects that are to this day, despite the delinking and the trade war, majority of these gadgets are still reproduced in China, bearing the label made in China. Sometimes have design in California, if it's Apple, but that label itself is a very important symbolic presence of the Tri-American entanglement that is very important to recognize if you try to think about China's presence and try to think about what that figure might do ideologically in shaping the media landscape.
I am anyway glued to TikTok these days, just looking at how Gen Z is responding to the election shift. And I just also found it, I'm late to the game, but the fact that TikTok is a Chinese-owned platform where it seems to me that's where a lot of the very exciting political interactions are taking place. And of course, not too long ago, we have all this attempt to ban the platform. There is this claim that I make about media not just as instruments for representation of politics, but as an environment in which politics takes place. And I found it interesting that so often we are hearing the term like, oh, the energy of the youth or the constituents that is unprecedented or hasn't been seen in years. And I was very intrigued by that. Perhaps there was some more room to develop this understanding of media as an environment for politics, like generating this energy in a way that fuels the machinery of the electorate.
Are we seeing like TikTok, maybe an example of that with the rise of social media? Can politics exist without media?
So, Mark, I'm especially intrigued by the activist context in your own work that have to do with Black Lives Matter, with TikTok, as we mentioned earlier, and how that activist impulse seems to travel through both of your works. So could you both comment a bit on that?
I think from an activist or political perspective, there's so much to untangle about some of the connections that you're making about breath and its invocation in the context of Chinese environmental activism, as well as Black Lives Matter activism. I think for me, something that stands out is thinking about TikTok as this activist space, transnational activist space. And from Black Lives Matter activism to more recent activism around Palestine, I think in the US, there's been a very interesting discourse about TikTok that links the Sinophobia and racialization of the Chinese state to just general kind of anti-progressive or anti-activist politics here in the United States. So there was a lot of talk about TikTok being this communist conspiracy to undermine a young American support for Israel because of the proliferation of pro-Palestinian content on TikTok, which I think is really collapses some of the intersections of what we're talking about here.
If you go back to earlier canonical works on nation and nationalism, like Benedict Anderson, there's so much to be said about the connection between nation, imagination of the nation, and media, in his case, print media, and in our case, a multiplicity of media platforms and remediating one another. And so this may be a point to, again, connect back to understanding media not just as discourses and content, but also material objects, all these possibilities for people to record George Floyd that generated the largest street protest in history. And yet, if we bring in the understanding of the workers who also struggle in COVID moment in iPhone factories in China, and that opens up this kind of possibility of this relational political reimagination. Oh, perhaps another dimension is the generation of e-wings of media as a very deep and troubling kind of trajectory of this explosion of personal gadgets and the constant upgrades that we somehow take for granted, the kinds of ideological work that goes into securing planned obsolescence. So those are ways in which the framing of media as environment and the environment as media can be very productive in thinking about politics.
And stepping very briefly outside of the American context, I'm thinking about how China is the largest supplier of personal devices across Africa, which itself has intimate ties with global circuits of e-waste.
This could be just a really quick connection. I had been working on Shenzhen Special Economic Zone in southern China that has a company called Trenshen that supplies Africa with this top-selling brand called Technophones. One of the interesting things, on the one hand, as you say, it said, Dolores, it can be understood as capital accumulation of Chinese capitalists. But on the other hand, there's an intriguing aspect to the fact that one of the reasons that these phones were so popular had to do with the fact that they take better pictures of darker skinned individuals, just implicitly challenging the normative whiteness that shapes the algorithms, designs of globally popular brands such as iPhones. I think that's another example of the need to continue to investigate what's happening in the Afro-Asian encounter. I think that the recent emergence of the framework of global Asia is a remapping, perhaps, thinking about some of the epistemological possibilities of connecting Asian American studies with the previous kind of area studies understanding of Asia and try to map out some new terrain of thinking about China or Asia as kind of these ageographical figures. So this is where Trimerica comes in as a very interesting metaphor, because in the play that I mentioned, there was one line that says it's not a place on a map, but certainly a lot of us do seem to be inhabiting that place that we call Trimerica. And I feel like by connecting China to the longstanding critique of racial capitalism, it's also a very important move in some ways, thinking about how the colonial past is remapped onto the post-colonial present, thinking about people of color globally, how they participate in the global digital economy, from the global mining of Congo to content moderators in the Philippines and the kinds of eye slaves that I mentioned that produce all the made in China gadgets. So thinking about these moments where people of color are participating in the production of the global digital economy is also, I feel like, still understudied in a way, needs to be made more visible in the study of media and globalization.
I think what makes this so interesting is that from my vantage point, I think one could argue that China also is an absent presence within the field of Asian American studies, which I think is interesting precisely because, as you were gesturing to, the origins of the field in the 1960s were very much in the context of student activism and engagements with third worldism and internationalism, and China as a kind of revolutionary image or imaginary served like a really crucial, I think, ideological and analytical role in the Asian American movement of the 1960s, as well as the birth of the field in the context of that movement. And yet, as you've been speaking to, I think it's been difficult in the 21st century for Asian American studies frameworks to make themselves flexible and adapt to this discourse precisely of rising China because of the field's own counter-hegemonic, I think, political impulses. I think the question of how do we engage with China as a contemporary state and also as a contemporary rhetorical device in American racial politics and discourse. And so I think that your book fits into this broader trend of kind of the transnational turn of Asian American studies, particularly vis-a-vis China in really important ways.
Yeah, thank you so much for, again, bringing up another point that I felt is worth highlighting too. You mentioned this kind of counter-hegemonic impulse of Asian American studies and the fact that there is the undeniable economic rise of China. And one may also argue a neoliberal turn of China, despite that you can call it the Beijing consensus as opposed to the Washington consensus. And at the same time, those legacies of Afro-Asian alliance from the 60s is not necessarily gone. If you also think about the rhetoric around the One Belt, One Road, of course, very controversial, multiplicity of projects, sometimes connected to the state, but other times not necessarily, and even at times retroactively grouped under One Belt, One Road. But at the same time, there is all these contestations between the neoliberal presence of America and China's arguably different kinds of developmental presence in places like Africa. So this is actually another project that I'm beginning to look into. And maybe that's another reminder too, that perhaps there's more to be done in connecting China to the workings of racial capitalism in light of these more recent Afro-China connections in connection to, say, the global 60s about anti-white struggles, both within the U.S. and globally. I think that's very important to still think about, just as you mentioned, Cold War lineage simultaneously evolving, but at the same time holding this kind of durability. But perhaps another way to think about it is these kind of counter-hegemonic anti-imperialist struggles from the 60s. In what ways do they also have a continual presence in the 21st century? That's very worthy a question to look into as well.
Fawn, I think this actually might be a good turn to think about your concept of fiscal orientalism and thinking about the work that does.
It was interesting to think about this rising China figure in relation to the longstanding framework of Orientalism. So I made the case that even though there's still very much use in thinking about Orientalism by Edward Said, talking about representation, but here you do have both in reality and imaginarily a figure that is more powerful than the American self. And at the same time, the action of this figure is not to be dismissed. Even though in this chapter, I talk about this in terms of a fiscal orientalism, acknowledging that the framework of Said still is quite useful. But later on, I move on to talk about perhaps China here is not a preformed object to be represented in these media. Instead, I theorize it as a figure co-constituted with Chinese American media. And so that is a different way to approach this figure that does not reduce it to something that's already static and there to be represented. So this is my attempt to move beyond the representational framework and try to think about this co-constitution of agent in media production and the media artifacts that make them visible. The fact that when you depict China in those terms, it also delimits the ways in which American politics can imagine the role of the state, particularly delimiting the possibility for the state to be a figure that is meant to secure the public good. So if you hear right-wing politicians routinely talk about government spending and not wanting to become like China, and that kind of rhetoric is performing the ideological work to argue that the state should be limited in becoming an agent of public good. So that's an important connection that is something we should continue to observe right now.
I'm also wondering if we can talk about the very first term on the cover of your book, this disorienting. So I'm thinking disorienting as being disoriented, right? Dizzy, unsteady, but also disorienting.
As you rightly pointed out, there is a pun. Several layers, I would say. Oh, one is, as you pointed out, there is a dizzying effect, perhaps, with this figural formation of rising China, in the sense that not sure exactly how to operate, as Mark also earlier pointed out, perhaps the impact on Asian American studies. That is another example to think about. How do we grapple with this rising figure? And I also found it really illuminating to go back to Sarah Ahmed's Queer Phenomenology book, where she talks about the operation of racism, how that is tied to this kind of orientation of the body. So if you think about that layer, the phenom encounter with someone who recognized him as a Black man. I also had this segment where you talk, where she talked about, or they talked about this encounter of people from other places when they encounter racism, say during COVID, anti-Asian racism. It's oftentimes predicated on this feeling of disorientation, feeling that they're out of place. They're not supposed to be here. So I think there's a very highly precise way to think about this disorienting effect of racism on people of color who are perceived to be from elsewhere and should go back to that elsewhere. And at the same time, Ahmed also had this other layer, which I really appreciated. Again, connecting that to the play that I analyzed, is that when we think about place-based politics and the space that is created by Trans-Pacific media, perhaps that also opens up a possibility of a environment for politics that is not necessarily tied to the ground of the nation, but just like the ocean of the Pacific provides a fluid environment for regrounding, so to speak, of our imagination of politics. So this is like tying back to this notion of relationality. Perhaps these moments, for example, in my conclusion, when I talk about the I Can't Breathe slogan in the Black Lives Matter movement and the kinds of deadly air pollution that you observe in China due to its status as the world's factory. So these very disparate experiences of not being able to breathe by people of color can be brought into a productive relational understanding to create this new ground, so-called quote-unquote ground, for rethinking politics. So I feel like there is the dialectical understanding of disorientation at work, in addition to rethinking the connection between China and Orientalism as well. So thank you for that.
So the displacement of the Orient as a space that is simply represented, as you said very early in your book, you're trying to peel away from this concentration on simple representation to move toward relationality, mutuality, and yet tension. So I think that, like you said, the title works on these different layers that very much are complementary, as well as thinking about this affect dizzying kind of effect of disorientation. Might we now discuss the concluding chapter and the ultimate conclusions that you draw, especially with breadth and ecological entanglement?
This is a chapter that I'm most curious to hear folks' reaction to, because it was written in the pandemic, just when we were returning to aspired normality. And so this notion of breathing that was so denaturalized, so breathing together, I should say, so denaturalized in that moment as we were just regaining that capacity to breathe together, had this impact on me, trying to think about, is there something to be done about air? Something that perhaps is another kind of medium, if we can relate to how scientists talk about the air pollution can travel from China back to the U.S. West Coast. Is that air Chinese air? Or is it because of the kinds of mass production of products in China for American companies that generated that air pollution that makes that air Chi-American air? So I found it interesting to think about this category of air and then jump from there to think about just the role of the state in tackling the climate crisis that we are arguably encountering in a more intensified manner. And some people have called the pandemic as a dress rehearsal for the oncoming climate crisis. So many in the environmental studies world would invoke the two biggest polluters on the planet, namely China and America, how the states of these two nations can be very important in addressing that kind of crisis. So I think for me, in addition to thinking about the Trans-Pacific air as Tri-American media, as a way to talk about the ecological entanglement of the two superpowers, it also brings the notion of relational politics back down to form the configuration of the state. So there's this concept of the green state that some political scientists have presented as a potential outlook. But of course, at this moment, even though in China there's a so-called ecological civilization official policy, there's still very much the notion of delinking that is on the minds of a lot of policymakers on both sides of the Pacific. So to what extent can we imagine our relational politics being mapped onto these state formations?
You mentioned that people have said the pandemic is perhaps a dress rehearsal for confronting the climate crisis. And I think if it is, we're all in a lot of trouble. Because from my vantage point, I feel that the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic was so circumscribed by geopolitical antagonism to China, and one that not only was staked to a critique or demonization of the Chinese state response, but one that really lacked a lot of simple human empathy for Chinese people. And I remember myself as a Chinese American in the early months of when here in the US, we were just starting to talk about what is this new virus that they found in China? Oh, Wuhan is locked down. There was very little, I think, solidarity, very little empathy. And I remember seeing one of my friends on Facebook, to bring in another media example, one of my friends on Facebook changed their profile to have one of those frames that Facebook puts out when different kind of events or crises happen, and put a filter on their profile photo that said, "My heart is with Wuhan," or something like that. And I remember being so moved and also sad to see that, because it was such a solitary expression of identification and solidarity with Chinese people. Whereas I think if COVID had unfolded in a different country, we would have seen a very different of response, both popularly and at the state level. And so I think that your call for kind of the more solidaristic understanding of our shared futures is one very moving to me personally, and I think also really emphatically important for confronting these global crises that are so intertwined.
Thank you again, Mark, Katie, and Fawn, for sharing your thoughts on this engaging book and its vital contribution to media studies, cultural studies, and Asian studies. Be sure to add Fawn's book, Disorienting Politics, Chimerican Media and Trans-Pacific Entanglements, published by University of Michigan Press, to your library. We'd also like to thank the entire Positions editorial and production team, along with our co-producers, Elaine Venter and Mark Nunez, whose work makes these episodes possible. And we also thank you, our audience, for your time and attention today. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our podcast and join us for the next episode of Positions, where we will tackle other essential and engaging topics in cultural studies.